Good afternoon to all of you again, and also good afternoon to those out in cyberspace. I often forget to address you. I'm sorry about that. It's just that the camera's hidden back there, and I don't really think about the fact that we're broadcasting live, but we appreciate you being with us. Yeah, I heard a number of comments this week about the checklist. Hopefully, you wives didn't think it was too unromantic to have a man that needs a checklist to do what he ought to be doing. So anyway, I'm pleased that at least, I hate to tell you this, but the whole notion of saying check was spontaneous. That wasn't in my notes. So apparently it was inspired because it gained a lot of traction because a number of people talked to me this week about it. But it shows the fact that it is important that we remember to do what God expects us to do, and that there are biblical tools, as we have termed them for this series, that makes marriages work. I'll just reiterate what I mentioned last week again, that marriage is not what you get on your wedding day, it's what you begin. It's something that needs continual attention and building throughout time if it is to be what God intended it to be. And I'll just mention by way of reminder, we did not mention the Bible seminar in the bulletin last week by mistake, but we're planning to have the biweekly Bible seminars, and what we're going to do now that we've completed the Kingdom of God series is I will continue the marriage seminar thing in the Bible seminar. So if you want that to continue, you're going to have to come to the Bible seminar instead of coming to services. Hint, hint. And after we complete that, I have a series that I plan to do. It'll probably be around about feast time or directly thereafter on the United States and Britain and prophecy. That'll be the next thing that I'm planning to do unless something else comes in between. I've got a series of Bible studies on that that I trust you'll find helpful, and I'm planning to bring in some additional information that is fairly recent that we've not talked about before. So that's just in the way of introduction. Today we're going to talk about another biblical tool to build a marriage. If you want titles, the title today is Do Benevolence or Meeting Your Spouse's Needs. And this is, since I think men need more instruction than women, this reciprocates, goes both ways, but we'll focus a little bit more on the women today. And I have here a news article that was handed to me some years ago by someone that said, well, maybe you could use this in a sermon. And I read the thing, and it's none other than Ann Landers. Some of you are old enough to remember Ann Landers, you know, that has all the answers to life's important questions. So you can see it's a little bit dated because the paper's faded, but she didn't have any answers to this one. So I'm getting in really deep and going where angels fear to tread. So bear with me. This is from Divorcing Her in Massachusetts, A Means to End a Marriage. Dear Ann Landers, here are my suggestions for women who want to end their sex lives and eventually their marriages, and I guarantee they will succeed. Number one, first desensitize your husband to the sexual aspects of your body. Replace the sexy girl he married with a drab, sloppy mommy. Gain weight. Don't bother to dress up unless you're going to a wedding or a funeral. I mean, whoa. Like I said, I'm going in deep. And where angels fear to tread, but I've got a big podium up here, so if things start getting thrown at me, I'll just hide behind the podium. This was given to me by someone in the congregation that said, maybe it was a challenge, whether I would be bold enough to use it. Well, I'm making use of it. So I can't take any responsibility for this. I'm just quoting Ann Landers. Continuing. Don't bother to dress up unless you are going to a wedding or a funeral. Stop wearing makeup, fixing your hair. Wear old, torn undergarments. After all, nobody will see them but him. Forget about personal hygiene. Soon your husband will stop asking for sex. Number two, cultivate a negative or indifferent attitude about intimacy. Act distracted and uninterested if your husband wants to discuss it. If he becomes amorous, use the old standbys. You have a headache or you're tired. Be overly involved with your children so that there will be no time for or energy left. Number three, if you must say yes because of his insistence, do so grudgingly and without enthusiasm. Criticize his technique and urge him to hurry up and get it over with. Act offended or embarrassed at any other new suggestions, and be sure to lie absolutely still and contribute nothing. Believe me, if you follow these instructions, you will end your marriage. Signed, divorcing her in Massachusetts. To which Ann Landers wisely replies, "Dear Massachusetts, your instructions for ending a marriage are perfect. I read your letter. I know you're speaking from experience. Your signature came as no surprise." She acknowledges that it works, but offers no suggestions on how to solve the problem. Now, we do not know the circumstances that led up to this person being so frustrated that he was willing and able to write this letter to a news columnist. So you know that the circumstances were pretty bad. We do not know if the writer was doing his part to build the relationship, but several things seem obvious. The behavior described by the writer will destroy a marriage, or at least make it miserable. The implication is that the relationship did not start out that way, so it begs the question on how it got to where it is. And we'll analyze, actually, I'm going to go through that letter, and we're going to analyze some of the things that were unsaid that show that the relationship did not start out that way. So the question is, how did it get to where it is? Since the Bible says God hates divorce, perhaps the Bible gives a better answer to divorcing her in Massachusetts than even Ann Landers in all her wisdom was able to offer. She just acknowledged that it was a problem, didn't offer any solutions. We'll go to the Bible in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Our primary scripture today is found over in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and we're going to begin reading in verse 3. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her. Check. Okay, here we have in a different scripture the same advice that we were given last week and we went into in great detail. But notice, and likewise also the wife to her husband. Some translations render this due benevolence or meeting, and I simply rendered it meeting your spouse's needs. But we notice here that when Paul was writing to the Corinthians, it was not a one-way street. Affection on the one hand and no reciprocation on the other. In any relationship, whether marriage or otherwise, requires interaction between the two parties or it ultimately will not work. Continuing, you know, as I mentioned, this scripture reiterates what we discussed a week ago, that the wife's need underlined for affection. And this scripture, Paul emphasizes the fact that the husband has a duty to give affection to her. But there is a reciprocal, the other side of the coin. The wife also has a responsibility to fill a need. Continuing on, in verse 5, do not deprive one another except with consent for a time that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So we see here that there's a connection here and a command that if there is deprivation, so to speak, there will be consequences. And Paul's admonition is that it does not go on. I mean, we're talking about prayer and fasting, and, you know, you can make your own calculation of how long that is. I mean, people don't eat for very long. I mean, there would be some serious problems. But the result of deprivation, as we saw in this letter, is dissatisfaction, frustration, resentment, extramarital affairs, and divorce. And a man should fulfill his duty as a husband, even if he needs a checklist. And a woman should fulfill his duty, her duty as a wife. Each should satisfy the other's needs. That's what Paul is saying here in chapter 7. So meeting each other's needs appear critical. What does the Bible have to say on this subject, and what tools are available to build a marriage? Let's go to the Song of Solomon. The Song of Solomon is interesting because it highlights what we talked about last week, and it highlights the other need we're going to talk about, the reciprocal. We'll begin reading in chapter 1, verse 2. Here we have the words of the Shulamite, or the wife. She says in verse 2, kiss me again and again, for your love is sweeter than wine. How fragrant your cologne and how pleasing your name. No wonder all the young women love you. So we see here that in the Song of Solomon, the expression of the need for affection. You know, we talked about the checklist. It says here, kiss me again and again. The first words out of her mouth express a need for affection. So, again, I just highlight that. But now, let's turn tables, and I'm going to read through here, and you will notice a certain word that will keep being repeated time and time again. Here are the words of the beloved. Verse 8. If you don't know, O most beautiful woman, follow the trail of my flock to the shepherd's tents. Verse 15. How beautiful you are, my beloved. How beautiful. Chapter 2, verse 2. Yes, compared to other women, my beloved is like a lily among thorns. Now that's something that a woman would love to hear. Chapter 4, verse 1. How beautiful are you, my beloved? How beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are like doves. Your hair falls in waves. Your teeth are white as sheep, newly shorn and washed. I mean, we probably would need to update that just a little bit, men, before you go ahead and use some of this terminology. Okay, there's also, if I remember, there's something about the Tower of Lebanon that I don't think would necessarily be appreciated that much. Verse 7 of chapter 4, you are so beautiful, my beloved, so perfect in every part. Now, if you haven't gotten the hint, the operative word is beautiful. Verse 9 of chapter 4, you have ravished my heart, my treasure, my bride. I am overcome by one glance of your eyes, by a single bead of your necklace. Chapter 6, verse 4. O my beloved, you are as beautiful as the lovely town of Tirzah. I'm not quite sure how a woman would be as beautiful as a town. But I've never been to the ancient town of Tirzah, so, you know, you might have been surprised. But again, the operative word is beautiful. Yes, as beautiful as Jerusalem, you are as majestic as an army with banners Look away, for your eyes overcome me, your hair falls in waves. Chapter 7, verse 1. How beautiful are your sandaled feet, O queenly maiden. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a skilled craftsman. Continuing in chapter 7, verse 5. Your head is as majestic as Mount Carmel, and the sheen of your hair radiates royalty. A king is held captive in your queenly tresses. So you see here that we can, and what else can we conclude from what we just read? I mean, it's really quite simple when you boil it down. The wife needs an affectionate husband, and a husband needs an attractive wife. I mean, those are some really basic things that unfortunately often get ignored in the marriage where they are appropriately placed and used illegitimately outside marriage. And we should take notice of that because, as I read from Ann Landers, there are consequences that are not conducive to building a productive and effective marriage. Now I'm going to go where angels fear to tread. You know, you're going to say, oh my, you know, beauty, you know, that sounds about as attractive to women, I suppose, that affection sounds to men. And as I mentioned last week, the challenge here and also the success in it is that each party is doing unselfish acts. But let's take a look at the example of the patriarchs. And we take it all the way back in time to Genesis chapter 12, please. Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12, beginning in verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there. For the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to Sarah his wife, "Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance." So here you have the patriarch Abraham that understood that he had a beautiful wife, so much so that he was concerned for himself, which was the wrong approach. Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, "This is his wife," and they will kill me, but they will let you live. In other words, they were going to kill him to get her because she was beautiful. Now, Sarah was over 65 years old at the time. And he was right. She didn't escape notice. In verse 13, he hatched a plan. "Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you." And so it was when Abram came into Egypt that the Egyptians sought a woman, that she was beautiful. And the princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh. And a woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. He treated Abram well for her sake, and he had sheep and oxen and male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abraham and said, "What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she is your wife?" So we see here that in the time of the patriarchs, the attractiveness of Sarai was to the point that she did not escape the notice of the king or the Pharaoh of Egypt. Let's go down, let's take a look at the next generation, Genesis chapter 24. Genesis chapter 24. In verse 16. Let's see here. Verse 15 of chapter 24 to get the context. And it happened before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her pitcher on her shoulder. Now notice what the servant noticed. Now the young woman was very beautiful to behold, a virgin, no man had known her. And she went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came up. And a servant ran to meet her and said, please let me drink a little water from your pitcher. And she said, drink, my lord. Then she hastened and let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. So when he went at Abraham's command to find a wife for Isaac, one of the noticeable criteria, and this is why I say I'm going where angels fear to tread, was that she was attractive. Now, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. We will talk about that a little bit more. I just wanted to highlight that. And in the third generation, that particular situation is probably more well known because Jacob wanted Rachel, right? Because of how she looked, she was more attractive than Leah. And of course, you know the story. It caused problems for the rest of his life. So let's take a look, going back to the Song of Solomon, under the subtitle Beauty in the Eyes of the Beholder. The Shulamite woman, remember when we read through those passages, the Shulamite woman, the beloved, continued to rave about her beauty. I mean, the operative word was beautiful. And yet when we read in chapter 1, verse 6, the Shulamite said, don't look down on me because of my color, because the sun has tanned me. My brothers were angry with me and made me work in the vineyard. Oh, the brothers were to blame. They send her out to the vineyard, and she was, because of her color, she was tanned. One translation puts this, you know, don't look down on me, you city girls, okay? At the time, she was not necessarily seen as the, you know, the picture-perfect woman. And yet, the one that was attracted to her and loved her thought that she was very beautiful. Yet the beloved showers her with all kinds of compliments about her beauty, as we read earlier. And here's an important point. It is highly unlikely that a man would ever marry a woman that he finds unattractive, just as it is unlikely that a young lady would marry a man that she finds harsh and inconsiderate and unaffectionate. What Paul is telling us in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 3 is that we have a responsibility to continue the need that was initially filled, or at least moved into that direction prior to and at the beginning of marriage. Unfortunately, this is often not the case. After marriage, it is quite common to let down when, in fact, that is when it should really begin. Again, as I mentioned before, what we see in our society is these tools being put to illegitimate use outside the confines of marriage and neglected inside the confines of marriage to the considerable damage of the institution. And nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to address it because we're not comfortable with it. And yet that is what, and without addressing it, we cannot make any changes. It has been said that a young woman marries a man expecting him to change, and he doesn't. while a young man marries a woman expecting her not to change, and she does. And that's kind of it's a saying. You know, how many young ladies, how many times have you heard a young lady say, well, he's going to change after I marry him. Well, good luck. I have news for you. He won't. And conversely, you know, you expect her not to change. Well, she will. So let's get this out in the open right away. The principle that is in operation here, and we'll go back to the ultimate source of all wisdom, Ann Landers, here in a minute. The principle is that it is not what one is unable to give in a relationship that causes the problem. It is rather what one is unwilling to give. And I'll give you an example. This is an extreme example, but I think it illustrates the point. The wife of a one-armed husband is not likely to resent the fact that her husband is unable to hold her in a warm embrace with both arms. It's not possible. In fact, brings to mind the fact we have an interesting neighbor. Our next-door neighbor across the street has no arms. I forget what happened. What happened, Susan? He had an electrical accident when he was about 11 years old, and for whatever reason, they had to amputate both of his arms. And you should watch him mow the lawn. He does it with a riding mower, and he steers with his foot. And, he just drives around all over the yard doing it, and, you'd never guess. You would guess because you see his foot on the steering wheel, and he's got one foot on the pedal and the other foot on the wheel, and he does just fine. Well, he's engaged, and we're invited to his wedding. He's getting married here real soon. He does not have two arms to embrace his wife. I don't think that's problematic because he's unable to do that. The principle, again, is it's not what one is unable to give in a relationship that causes a problem. It's what one is unwilling to do. A wife, for example, the wife of a fully equipped husband will resent the fact that he is unwilling or negligent in using his capable arms to show her the affection due her. It's not what one is unable to give that is problematic. It is what one is unwilling to give. Now, of course, it's not a problem here any longer because we all have checklists, right? Fulfilling these needs is a powerful tool, and we are competing with a multi-billion-dollar industry out there in the media. We've all heard the saying that sex sells. Well, maybe it does sell. You know why it sells? Fifth Avenue has understood that in order to draw attention to a product, you have to do something that will get people's attention. So they appeal to our baser instincts in order to do that. And we live in a world that is highly centralized, and that's what we are competing with. There are biblical tools designed to be used within the confines of marriage to build a strong relationship that is designed to last through all the ups and downs of life. You know, life, when you are young and you're getting ready to get married, all the bad things will happen to everybody else. We're going to live happily ever after, and everything's going to be wonderful, and we'll be rich and famous, and, nothing can or will go wrong. It's just not a realistic picture, but that's how many people go into the relationship. That's the expectation. It doesn't quite work that way. Back to Ann Landers. Let's look at one of the statements that this frustrated individual in Massachusetts made. First, desensitize your husband. Replace the sexy girl he married with a drab, sloppy mommy. Gain weight. Now, let's notice something. Number one, He did not marry someone that he found unattractive. That's what we said earlier. Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. It is highly unlikely that a young man would marry a woman that he finds unattractive. You know, it's a good thing that beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, because if all men beheld beauty with the same criteria, we'd have a lot of problems, right? Because everybody would want the same woman. That would cause a big problem. Even in his situation of frustration, what is implied here is that he did not marry someone that he found unattractive at the outset. That wasn't the problem. It's what it became. He is complaining because the girl he married became unattractive. And again, I say, I'm going where angels fear to tread, but it's important. Notice he does not mention that his spouse was unattractive because she was old, or put any other descriptors in there that you want. He mentions sloppiness, drabness, weight gain, and other aspects, all of which are within one's ability, albeit sometimes difficult, to control. That's what built the resentment. Proverbs 15, verse 18 says this, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times, and always be enraptured by her love." That's the ideal. That's the ideal that we are to strive for, even in the difficulties of life. Let's go to this book, which, again, it's offered on this program. No, it's not free, and you have to pay for it. But Borders sells it. I know, because that's where I got this one. But I do highly recommend this particular book, because it talks in a lot more detail than I can in a couple of sermons about some of these situations, and it's good to read. Again, and I'll digress, marriage is no different from any other thing. It's something that you need to work on to build. It needs nurture. It needs care. It needs to be protected. And marriage is an institution that is under assault. The media, the liberals in our country want to destroy marriage, or maybe I should just let those labels off and simply state Satan wants to destroy marriage. He knows that marriage is the foundational building block of a civil society, hence he wants to destroy it. But anyway, let's go to page number 49 and notice what Dr. Harley says in this connection. Why men often wind up feeling cheated. When a man chooses a wife, he promises to remain faithful to her for life. This means that he believes his wife will be his only sexual partner until death do us part. He makes that commitment because he trusts her to be interested in him as he is in her. He trusts her to be available to him whenever he needs her, and to meet his sexual needs just as she trusts him to meet her emotional needs. And again, this is an issue that requires unselfishness on both parts. Unfortunately, in many marriages, the man finds that putting his trust in this woman has turned out to be one of the biggest mistakes in his life. this is a candid expression from a counselor that has talked to thousands of couples. He's saying that many men find out that this was the biggest mistake of their life. And that's not the way it should be. It's just an observation that he made. He has agreed to limit his sexual experience to a wife who is unwilling to meet that vital need, and he finds himself up the proverbial creek without a paddle. If his religious or moral convictions are strong, he may try to make the best of it. Some husbands tough it out, but many cannot, and they find sex somewhere else. Let's take a look at page number 108. Well, before we go there, let me take a look at another aspect of Ann Landers. Don't bother to dress up unless you are going to a wedding or a funeral. Stop wearing makeup and fixing your hair. Wear old torn undergarments. After all, nobody will see them but him. Notice, and again, we notice what he didn't say. Apparently, there was the ability to dress tastefully at weddings and funerals, which happens, depending on how many nieces and nephews you've got, you know, a couple times a year. He didn't say, it was possible, even in this neglected and frustrated situation, he still found her to be attractive. The problem was that she didn't choose, as many men neglect to say, I love you, and give affection. She chose not to dress tastefully or attractively, except at weddings and funerals. Number two, this man who married an attractive woman now finds himself married to a bag lady. Now, let me get in deeper, okay? Let's take a look at 108. I promised you last week that we could all be equally offended, so I'm trying to make good on that promise. And please, if you are offended, talk to me afterward, and we'll work that out. These are things that are important. They need to be discussed, and I hope you appreciate my candor, because we live in a world where all of these things are out in the open all the time in the wrong context. So let's get it right according to the Bible. That's my goal. But here is page 108. He needs a good-looking wife, an attractive spouse. So let me read you a story. At 26 and 190 pounds, Nancy seldom had dates, 4 in the last 2 years to be exact, and no calls back after the first one. Her prospect for marriage seemed bleak, to say the least. Even though she had a charming personality and many interests, few men wanted to date her. I mean, we can complain about that, but I mean, it's a reality of life. One day, Nancy decided she had to make a change. She wanted to marry. She was tired of her job. If I had someone to take care of me, she thought, I could quit the job and stay at home all day. So, what did she do? As her first tactic in achieving that goal, Nancy enrolled in an exercise program, went on a diet, lost 60 pounds. Next, she bought some new clothes that nicely accentuated her new figure. A new hairdo and appropriate makeup completed the transformation. Now, this sounds probably about as interesting to a woman as giving affection to your wife does to men. So bear with me. With 60 pounds gone and other improvements, Nancy became a real knockout. Now she had dates right and left. I mean, how can men be so... I mean, I know what you're thinking. How can men be so... what's the word? Short-sighted. Or there's another word I want. I'll think of it in a minute. So shallow, okay? Well, that's just the way they're made, I guess. Now she had dates right and left, but she had not forgotten her goal, a husband. About 8 months later, when Harold proposed, she said yes. She had achieved her goal with great speed. So far, so good. When I counseled Nancy and Harold about 5 years later, I started by speaking to them separately. Harold told me, the first thing she did after we were married was to quit her job. Well, remember, that was her goal. She said, if I would get married to someone that would take care of me, I could quit this job, stay at home. So she went out and lost 60 pounds. Now, he didn't know that that was her goal, so he's complaining to the counselor. Then she stayed at home eating like mad all day. She blew up like a balloon. That wasn't what he had bargained for. He didn't know. Actually, this is a fact that came out in the counseling. He didn't know her previous life and that her goal was to stay at home and eat. And that wasn't part of the bargain. She blew up like a balloon. She gained about 100 pounds since we've been married. Now, I don't know if it was 100, but probably, you know, at least it seemed that way to him. Have you said anything about her weight? I asked. Oh. Now we're really in trouble. Yes, many times, he said. In fact, it's a sore point between us. But she just says, I want you to love me for who I am. Of course she does. And of course, she no longer is what he thought he married. Remember? Men think that they're going to marry a woman and she will never change, but she does. Whilst women marry a man knowing that they will change and they don't. They get worse. And it provides a lot of material for Hollywood. I want you to love me for who I am. If you'd love me and accept me unconditionally, then I could easily lose this weight. I mean, come on. Now we've got fireworks. I'm getting fed up, Harold continued. I don't know where to turn. I don't believe in divorce. But I can't handle this, and something has to happen. As we continued to talk, I could see Harold face the real dilemma. I mean, he was up the creek, the proverbial creek, without a paddle, because he was reared in a conservative church, held strong convictions about marriage being a commitment for life. But whereas he had once looked forward to a happy future with a wife everyone seemed to admire, now life with Nancy seemed like a prison sentence. Marriage to this woman had hardly lived up to his expectation. Where had he gone wrong? Next, I talked to Nancy to get her side. She told me about her self-improvement program to get dates and a husband. It was a program. She had a goal. Nancy had never told Harold that she had once weighed so much or that she didn't think she could keep the weight off after marriage, for her dieting had been agony, and even keeping slim was too great a sacrifice if it was for life. So she had her own life sentence. After she had achieved her goal, she went back to life as it was, and her husband received the life sentence. When she married Harold, she thought he would love her regardless of her weight. She could go back to being fat and happy. She didn't like not being fat and happy. So when he told her he was leaving, if she didn't lose weight, she felt he was being unfair. And you can kind of see the dynamics where in fact, I mean, if you just look at it objectively, he married someone that he found attractive that was not being forthright with what her objectives was. She wanted to have a husband, by her own admission, so that she could stay at home and not have a job and be fat and happy. I mean, just to put it crassly. Granted, some men don't care about physical appearance. Their wives can be overweight or underweight. It makes no difference. They have other emotional needs that are far more important than the need for an attractive spouse. But Nancy had not married one of these men. In fact, she had married a man for whom physical appearance was at the very top of his list. He needed an attractive wife. So, continuing, Nancy listened intently as I explained that a marriage commitment means meeting the needs of your mate. She wanted Harold to earn a good living, be affectionate to her, talk with her often, and so on, but she wasn't holding up her end of the bargain. "What do you mean, not holding up my end?" she snapped. "I cook good meals. I keep the house. I'm affectionate." "All that is good, but you're missing something," I explained. "Your physical appearance is very important to your husband. This isn't some quirk or whim. It's something he needs very badly. The beautiful woman he married hides under all the excess weight. By taking care of your body, you take care of your husband." Nancy didn't quite hear me at first. She persisted in arguing, "Harold should love me as I am. You want to be loved for who you are and not for what you do," I said. "We all do, but you didn't decide to marry your husband for who he is, but rather for what he did. If he had not met any of your emotional needs when you dated him, you would not have even considered him as a life partner. And if after you were married, he stopped meeting your needs, your feelings for him would have changed considerably. Your love would have simply faded away." It's an excellent example of the fact that in a marriage, we need to do what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 3, meeting each other's needs. Now, we're highlighting one that is prominent among men. It's important that he finds her attractive, and beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Just the same way that a woman, generally speaking, not in all cases, wants a husband to be affectionate to her above and beyond what men normally would want to do. You know what the bottom line is? The bottom line is that we need to think and respond to the needs of our spouse. It's not about us. It's about giving in the relationship, not what we are getting. This guy married a woman that was something that she was actually faking. The happy ending to the story is that she lost her weight again and became what she had been when he dated and married her, and they lived, quote-unquote, happily ever after. One of the things that I find interesting about this particular counselor, instead of doing the stereotypical counseling where someone comes in and unloads the stereotypical couch and he says, yes, I understand, that's wonderful, I understand how you feel, he actually has tangible advice on how to change life for the better. And that's effective counseling. That is also appropriate. You know, just going to a counselor to unload and not changing anything doesn't help anybody except the counselor's bank account. And they can get very expensive. Let's go to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. And we'll read starting in verse 27. Here we have a section of Scripture in which Jesus Christ amplifies the law. And he talks about the fact that he will not come to destroy the law and the prophets. He talks about the fact that murder is an attitude of mind that starts in the heart. And then in verse 27, he says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery." And later in here, he talks about in chapter 5, verse 31. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Jesus Christ elevates the application of the law to an entirely new level. It's the spirit and the intent of the law as opposed to just the letter. And I just love to get into an argument with somebody that says they're fulfilling the spirit of the law, the letter doesn't matter. I mean, it's an impossible, irrational, ludicrous notion. It's not possible. You cannot keep the spirit of a law without also keeping the letter. It doesn't work that way. But notice back in starting in verse 27, notice he says, you have heard it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery, referring to the physical act. And then he continues, but I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So he expects men in the church of God to have a much higher standard than certainly what was practiced in his day and ours. I mean, the culture of Christ's day in many respects was not that different from what we are seeing today. And if you look at the letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians and all the problems that they have within the church, and if you read about the history and the culture and sexuality and marriage and what the attitudes were at that time, it wasn't that different from today. And that's evident even in the Jewish community because of how the Pharisees came to Jesus Christ and said, you know, is it okay to divorce a woman for just any reason? And that was the practice. I mean, you didn't like your wife. You just gave her a bill of divorcement and sent her on her way. Josephus, most of you have heard of Josephus. Josephus mentions in his writings about the wife that had borne him 3 or 4 children that he gave a bill of divorcement. Why? Because he didn't like her manners. I mean, that was the culture at that time. It's not that different from today, unfortunately. However, having read this, let's look at the other side of the coin. The other side of the coin in this particular passage is that as a wife, there is a responsibility to fill the need of attractiveness, whatever that is. Whatever that is. And again, it is different in different relationships. I mean, you get a book. I mean, it's cookie cutter. I mean, he takes the normal, the average, what is most prominent. You need to learn in your relationship as a husband and wife, you need to have a clear enough communication so that you know what the other's needs are and meet them. That is, after all, why you got married in the first place. Let's go back to there's a funny story in here. I won't read the entirety. I'll just give you the Reader's Digest version about this woman that married a rich man. Well, he was a rich farmer. And she thought she could put up with anything for the money. Again, that shows ulterior motives. And it's important to get into a relationship, marriage in particular, with honest motives, whatever it is. But anyway, the story is that this guy showered every 2 weeks, whether it was necessary or not, chewed tobacco, and they ended up in this doctor's office, and the marriage wasn't working, and they couldn't understand why. Well, he made him make a commitment that he would take a shower. Remember, this is a farmer. How many of you have grown up on a farm? Not that many, but just let your imagination do some work. I mean, you've cattle to take care of. You've got manure to haul. You've got all these things that farmers do. And you only shower once every 2 weeks, whether it's necessary or not. Okay? Yes. I mean, I think you can get the drift. So he told them that he would give them advice, but they would have to promise to follow it for just 1 week. His assignment was that he was to shower twice a day, morning and evening, and go to the dentist and not chew tobacco in the house. They came back a week later to his office holding hands. So, you know, we can make the cop out that personal hygiene, you know, these things don't matter. The reality is they do. The reality in any relationship, marriage or otherwise, is that it's not the big things that cause the problems. It's the stupid little things that we take for granted that end up piling up until it becomes a big problem. You ever notice, I'm going to tell you a story about myself. You know, boys are boys, you know, and, you know, once upon a time, many, many years ago, you know, I found a young lady that I found particularly attractive. And, of course, you do everything to impress her. And, you know, what do guys do when they date? They polish their car and, you know, they do all these things. They open doors. They do all kinds of wonderful things. Well, I didn't have a car. I had, and this sounds really romantic, I had a horse and carriage. And the song says, love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage, right? So we were off to a good start. I would spend most of my Saturday afternoon polishing that black buggy to a sheen. Why? I don't know. I mean, you wanted to impress her. Well, what happens, the question is, what happens 5 or 10 years hence, or 20 or 30? The reality is that while things change, certain basic things are still there. You know, when she looks good, he feels good, and when he feels good, things work, you know. Those are dynamics that are there, they're real. And they either work or they don't. In the case of him, you know, it's the car, it's the doors that no longer get opened, it's the flowers that don't arrive anymore, it's, what do you mean, I don't love you? I told you that when we got married 20 years ago, and I still mean it. I meant it then, it still means something. The reality is that when it comes to affection, a woman generally wants to see that repeated often. And when it comes to the attractive spouse, that is something that also needs to continue on a go-forward basis. So let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 in verse 3, where we began. First Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 3. And actually, it would be good for you to take the time to read the entirety of chapter 7, if you're married and if you're not. It has a lot of instruction that is helpful. But verse 3, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, even if you need a checklist. And likewise also the wife to her husband. So what's the plan. Here's the plan. And it's not a checklist. Well, it's a two-point plan. And it's very simple. It's two words. Ask and then do. Ladies, ask your husband what he finds attractive and what he does not. And I guarantee you he'll tell you. And then do what 1 Corinthians chapter 7 says. And likewise also to wife to her husband, rendering due affection. Ask what it is, and then have a plan of action and do it, because when she looks good, he feels good. Husbands have a need to have an attractive wife to have and to hold. We can say with confidence that this is one of the reasons he married her in the first place. You know, think about it. Just think about the relationships you know about, the people that you know that dated and got married. How many do you know? How many young men, how many old men, for that matter, do you know that married a woman that they did not find attractive? The answer is, if not zero, very close to it. Wives are admonished to use this tool to build their marriage. To the extent that you do this, the marriage will be strengthened. To the extent that you fail to fill this need, the marriage will suffer. Brethren, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. These are biblical tools that build marriages that last the way God intended them to last.